Welcome on to a special edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. We have a great guest today, someone who I actually am talking to for the first time, but we've corresponded thousands of times on Twitter, NBA better extraordinaire Bob Valleros. Bob, welcome on.
Hey, Nate. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting that this is the first time we're talking. You obviously see a lot of the Clippers in person, and you know, I think we both felt like they're in pretty good shape in this series, and then they somehow managed to blow it. I mean, how do you think this happened? Is this random? Was it, you know, them running out of gas? What's the deal?
I think there's a bunch of narratives you can probably – you could probably pick any one of a number of things and find a bunch of justifications to prove your point. But I don't know. It was a combo of things. I certainly never expected that they would lose the series after they won game one. I thought it was just, I mean, as long as Chris Paul could come back, of course. But with the idea that Chris Paul, I mean, I kind of knew that Chris Paul was going to play game three, and be, you know, pretty healthy or fairly healthy, after game three and four, it was, I don't know how anyone could have thought Houston could have come back. I don't know that they ran out of, I mean, I do feel like they ran out of gas, but I don't think it was, if it was that, it was definitely a combination of mental, just them mental fatigue as well as physical fatigue, because they did look like they were tight in game six down the stretch. Nobody wanted to shoot. And then Houston made some good adjustments, I think. I mean, some of it was luck, obviously. Josh Smith going off for all those threes, that's not something you want to bank on for a long time. But I think they were the better team today for sure. I don't think anyone can dispute that. They played better. Their players are more comfortable shooting. Their players are more comfortable running their offense. The Clippers looked like they weren't really sure what they wanted to do or where they wanted to go. And then they just made the better adjustments in terms of players. They had more moves. The Clippers really didn't have any moves they could do. They have their starting five, and that's pretty much about it. So.
Yeah. What struck me the most here, I mean, and obviously that perhaps the number one point is just the lack of depth for the Clippers. Maybe I should start there, because you look at the type of guys that Daryl Morey was able to get basically for free or at very little cost, you know, compared to the guys that the Clippers had coming off the bench. I mean, if the Clippers have just a backup point guard like Pablo Prigioni or something, someone that Morey basically got for free during the year, maybe they win this series, you know?
Yeah, they didn't have a backup point guard, and that's remarkable when you think about it. You know, the narrative is that people are going to try to spin is that, you know, Chris Paul's a choker, or he's never been to the Western Conference Finals.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
And if you look at, yeah, it's this team was, I don't think you can find a team that had a bigger disparity between starting five and bench as this team has. And not even just bench, but just like player six and seven. I mean, the difference between starting five and player six and seven is so strong. And I mean, you know, you could disparage Barnes and maybe put him, but I do think he's a valuable player for them. But their bench is terrible, which made it all the more shocking when those guys just played out of their minds in game in a few of the early games. When Rivers had his game where he just went crazy, and he actually had a good game in Houston as well. And Crawford, it's interesting. I don't know, because I'm trying to rationalize to myself, because I went in thinking this bench is terrible, and I didn't think they had a chance to win any of the games in Houston. And then they won game one, and I was like, because I really wanted to bet against the Rockets to start. That was like my thing. I wanted the Spurs to advance, and I was probably going to be making some of the bigger bets I've ever made in the playoffs based on what I thought the line would be on the Spurs in every game. And then that didn't happen, and I wanted to do the same thing with the Clippers, and then the Chris Paul injury occurred, and I was like, okay, well, obviously you can't bet this team without Chris Paul. And I was kind of shocked at how well, like, that Blake Griffin, that point guard thing works when the other team is not ready for it.
Yeah.
I don't think it works the second time you try to go to it, or the third time. So it's weird. I don't know. The stuff that worked in game one, though, they never really went to that when Paul was out, the stuff they were doing in the first two games when Paul was injured. They never really went to that when he was just taking his rest in the series. The stuff they were running when he was out of the game, when he was healthy, I thought was some of the worst offense that I've seen. It was just basically, let's just set a high screen and have Jamal Crawford take a long two over and over and over again. And I don't think you can win doing that when teams are aware of that's what you're trying to do. There's no adjustment. There's no adjustment to what happens when the guy actually shows on him and now he's got to take a contested shot because he's never going to pass the ball ever.
No, he really isn't. I mean, he was 6 out of 18 today. And really, like, a lot of times, too, when he'll get going in the first half of a game, like, he was sort of, oh, Jamal Crawford is bringing them back, you know, in that
early. That's dangerous, second. Right?
Yeah, totally dangerous. Like, because you know he's going to keep shooting. Like, his good games sometimes are more damaging than his bad games because that's just giving him a license to fire away.
And you could definitely make that argument for Rivers as well because, you know, he went off. Like, that game, that was one of the most – I mean, I actually had goosebumps watching that. I was at the game, and I was like, this is ridiculous because I'm probably one of the more vocal Austin Rivers critics around, and to see him play like that just shows you that both yeah, guys that are in the NBA do have talent, and they are good at one thing, and they do have the ability. Like, if you take away the game and just watch them warm up, they're really good, and that's kind of what that game was in some ways for them. He was just making ridiculous shots, and the ball was flying, but yeah, it didn't seem like it was sustainable, but it also didn't feel like there was any way Houston could really deal with the Clippers starters and what would happen when Dwight gets into foul trouble. I do think the big thing that Houston did that helped them is they stopped the Hakka stuff. Because if you look at the last two games they won, they didn't really do it at all. And game five in Houston, they didn't really do it very much then either. And I do think that was a big, when you have a team that has no depth like the Clippers do, and you're just adding all these extra stoppages in play for your players to recoup and rest, I do think it helped them a lot. It helped the Clippers a lot. It helped Chris Paul and Blake Griffin not be as fatigued knowing that there was just going to be like a 15-minute period or a 20-minute period in the first half where you're just going to be standing around.
Yeah.
And that helped a lot. And then it also helped them not have to worry about having these terrible players have to create offense. You saw what happened when the Clippers had to actually create offense on their own. Like, they didn't come back in game six by hacking. They came back in game six by defending and stopping the Clippers, you know, to a certain extent. I think DJ only shot a few free throws that game, 8 free throws or something like that.
Yeah. It was, you know, that's two points that I think coming out of this. One is that I think that teams in general, and or maybe not teams, maybe the media and some of the smarter teams may be onto this, that not all minutes are created equal. It's how many minutes you're playing consecutively. It's whether you can catch a blow because there are a lot of fouls.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think a lot of the Rockets, with all the times they get fouled, they can recover. Same thing with the Clippers. They're a high foul team. And that's one of the Warriors' chief advantages to me is they don't foul that much. And if there's a game where the refs aren't blowing their whistle a lot, like, the other team gets run into the ground.
Yeah. And that's a team where you really see, I was watching the games with my girlfriend, and that's a team where you look and it's a 2-point game and then you blink and it's like a 10-point game. They go on these like massive binges led by 3-pointers and just running the paces so fast. If you look at that team, actually plays at such a high pace. Their opponents play at such a slow pace when they're playing him. So like the artificial pace count in terms of how many possessions are in a game, it's kind of not really as accurate an indicator, because if you look, they're getting the ball and even not even shooting the ball, but just the ball is across half court in 3 or 4 seconds every time. They're in their
offense. Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, it's really remarkable, and there isn't really any other team that is doing that. I think the Spurs did that a little bit the year they won, and they did it as well the year they lost the year before. And this year they didn't really do it as much. I think a lot of that had to do with Parker not being healthy. But it is a big advantage when you can get the ball and fatigue the other team when you're used to playing at that pace, and you also have some depth of some sort. Although the Golden State bench wasn't exactly terrific during the regular season, but I think a lot of that was just playing in artificial environments where the game wasn't even a real basketball game anymore when you're up 20 in the fourth, right?
So the other thing I wanted to ask you is, one of my observations from this series is just after the Rockets got down 3-1, they just started playing harder to me. I mean, like that game one, you were very critical of their effort overall, that they just didn't come to play. They gave up.
They just thought they won the game. They just thought they were, Chris Paul is out, we're going to roll these guys. And you could see it, lazy pass. I mean, how many lazy passes did James Harden make in the last four games? Almost, I can't think of any. You know, those little bounce, those little behind the back passes, the little bounce pass where he's trying to slip the ball through in the pick and roll. You saw a ton of those in the first few games. and you didn't see, well, mind you, he didn't play very much in game six, but he didn't turn the ball over very much today, that's for sure. Or at least, you know, throw very many lazy passes. And yeah, the bench was just like Prigioni coming in. How are you stealing inbound passes in a game seven? How does that happen? After a basket, how are you stealing? He had two of those.
Yeah, I mean, that you could, maybe you can point to that as being some of the mental fatigue. I mean, that's, fatigue is always so nebulous, and sometimes I'll discount it because people just use it as an excuse for everything. But in, on the other hand, it's real, and I think you can notice it, especially with this Clippers team. They really, you know, some of their main guys just ran out of gas, and Redick, I think, couldn't buy a shot. Crawford couldn't either in the last few games of the series, and they were fast breaking Houston like crazy through game four. They had a ton of fast break points in three and four,
yep.
And then that really got shut down the last three games. Their whole offense did, relative to where they had been.
Yeah, they did. There was a lot of, I think the thing with Redick is, for him, I don't even think it was, I talked a little bit about Korver, I can't remember with who, but somewhere. And the thing with Korver was he was just facing really good defense. And I think with Redick, it was, he got fatigued from actually being the guy, the go-to guy, who was guarding Harden. And I think that's the big mistake that Doc made, was it worked really, really well, but him, you know, wanting to play Jamal Crawford over Barnes was just, it just put too much pressure on Redick. Redick has to guard Harden and has to, like, it's not like Redick gets his offense from just standing in the corner, catching and shooting. He's running off screens to get, that's his game. And that's the stuff they have designed for him. He's like, it's almost like a Ray Allen type of role that he's Ray Allen in Doc's offense, basically. And you could just see it. I mean, he got worn down. I mean, he's never been a defensive stopper ever. And
yeah, he was missing open shots. You know, it's not like he was taking bad shots those last three games.
How about the turnovers he had? He had these two passes today that were just mind boggling, where he just threw the ball in the backcourt one time and threw it out of bounds another time. And that's, I don't think that's choking. I think that's fatigue. I mean, I think he is I don't use the word choke. I don't use it very lightly because I think it's easy to say someone's choking while you're sitting on your couch watching them play. It's a lot more difficult to actually try to figure out the reasons why it's happening. And I think the fatigue and the mental fatigue and all that just kind of wears on people.
Well, so I think there is an argument here that the Clippers kind of fell on some bad luck. They couldn't hit a three these last three games. And then they also, you know, the Rockets started getting some crazy outside shooting contributions from guys like Smith and Brewer. But on the other hand, I mean, they lost all three of these games by double digits. So you got to think maybe there's something there too.
It is crazy though, because they were, I don't know how you lose a game you're winning by 19, how you lose that game by 12 in game six. That to me was like the most amazing thing. It wasn't that they lost, but that they also somehow managed to get blown out. And I mean, getting outscored 40-15 in the fourth quarter, that's unheard of. And so, yeah, I mean, I do think there was a little bit of luck in that game. I mean, I don't know what happens if Harden plays instead of the bench guys, and you have like Corey Brewer making threes. And they weren't even just the threes, the players making the threes. It was the type of threes. It was like the Josh Smith dribble threes. Those, I don't know what he's shooting on those for the year, but I'm guessing what was he, like 4 of 7? I think Brewer only missed, I don't know what Brewer was that. I think Brewer from three was pretty hot in the fourth quarter as well. So.
Yeah, combined 5 of 7 in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, it's just huge for those two guys. So I do think that there's a little bit luck in that. But I do think you also make your luck. That team never gave up. But you have to give them credit for that. A lot of teams or a lot of players would just give up in that spot. I think the Clippers, in some ways, gave up in some games. They gave up in the last game in game six. Or, excuse me, in game five. And in Houston, to their credit, they just kind of gave up. They thought, oh, we're just going to come back. It felt like they just thought they were going to come back and win the next game at home. But it is unfortunate, but I do feel like you get what you deserve in some ways. And I remember going to the Spurs series, and I was cheering for the Spurs. And I remember, like, some of the people who sit in my section were like, why are you cheering for the Spurs? And I was like, how could you cheer for this team? and it's not because I don't like Chris Paul, because I do. And it's not because I don't like DJ, because I do, or Redick. It's just because, like, how can you cheer for a team where this coach has all this power and is the president?
Yeah, that's what it is for me.
And
too.
It's just, I just can't reward that. I can't reward a guy who spends his off season, you know, thinking about Eastern Conference players that beat him in like 2008 and trying to sign them to deals to his team. Like, it's an absolute joke. The players they signed on like the waiver wire or they picked up as free agents throughout the years, they're all like old players who, like, just think of even the players that didn't even stick on that team. Forget about the guys who are still on the team. Think about the players he auditioned, like Steven Jackson and Charles Douglas Roberts and Byron Mullins. And you could just go on and on and on with all these players that he thought would work. And I don't see any other team making these types of decisions. It's really remarkable. That was really hard for me to cheer for that. I just really thought that it's like, how do I want to root for this guy? And I'm sure he's a good guy and a great coach, but he has no business making personnel decisions at all, like zero.
Well, so let me ask you, what did you think at the time of the Haws and Farmar signings? Like, Farmar going south to me is one of, like, the biggest kind of underrated aspects of the season.
Yeah, you know, I honestly thought Jordan Farmar was a good basketball player. I thought that was an okay signing. I thought it would work out. I was actually shocked to see how poorly he played after, you know, he went and played, he played for Brooklyn, right? And then he went and played in Europe somewhere or in the Israeli league or something like that. And I was kind of shocked at how bad he was. So, but the Haws signing, I never thought that the Haws signing was a big signing for them. I do feel like one of the things he did do right was there was a lot of like pressure for him to trade DJ for Garnett or something like that. I don't remember that. That was maybe before he had like the full power, but I think like, well, that was part of the deal they were talking about when he first came over. And I think he was the...
Yeah, well, I think they were actually, it might have been saved from himself, because I think what happened was
Zeke said
you can't trade now because it would be imputed as part of the compensation for Doc.
But I also do remember him, and maybe he wanted to and then he couldn't, so he spun it. But I also do remember him specifically touting DJ and saying, I would never trade DJ and I want DJ.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if that was a psychological thing or what, but I do feel like that would have been a disaster for the team. Because obviously the team has no rim protection whatsoever without DJ. It's weird. I don't know. I don't know exactly. I'm still shocked. I don't know how they lost the series. It's so bizarre. It's very rare that you see a team come back from 3-1 in such a way where it looks like one team is just it wasn't like the games were close and they could have went either way. Those two games in LA were an absolute bloodbath. I mean, Houston could not stop them. In any way, they had no answers for him.
Yeah, I mean, that was just that's what just shocked me was how Houston was able to get it together defensively. And maybe it was just more of an emphasis in transition. And you throw in that with the fact that they just missed shots, and maybe that's all it is. I mean, how much credit do you give to McHale for some of the adjustments that he made?
I think their coaching staff is pretty is their defensive coach, JB Bickerstaff. I think he's put together a pretty good defensive game plan for the most part. If you look at the personnel on that team, even when Dwight was out, for them to be as good as they were defensively, you have to credit the scheme in some ways. Beverly went down, Howard was out for a big portion of the year, and they were able to defend. So I do give them credit, whether it's McHale. I do think that the part that really helped them a lot, and maybe someone will disagree with on the staff or something, but I do feel like them getting away from the hacking really helped them, because I do feel like it galvanized their team in some ways and made them think like, okay, we can get stops. We can do this. It does build on momentum. They are able now to run. And that's a team that lives in transition and early shots and early offense. And so for them to be able to, you know, actually defend and play. Another thing is if you actually watch the games where they were fouling, they had no idea. There was no communication. Like, who are we supposed to be fouling? Yeah. Who's the guy to foul? You know, in game four, I think they fouled out almost their whole, every player on their starting lineup had like a bunch of fouls at one point. And it's just not, it's like that type of strategy, I think, works really, really well in a laboratory and on paper. And I think that there's a bunch of intangibles that come into play. And it happened with the Spurs too. I was not a fan of the way the Spurs did it, because for the Spurs, I think it did affect their actual offense versus a set defense. And I think for Houston, it just affected them in a way that it just gave the Clippers too much rest. And it probably did that for the Spurs too. I didn't really realize it because maybe it wasn't as tangible. And I think there was like maybe more breaks or it was earlier in the playoffs. But yeah, it's tough.
I thought Mikhail putting Smith into the starting lineup was a very good move. I think he's just, he can be flighty at times, but he also is capable of playing some pretty good defense when he's locked in. And obviously, I mean, you know, whether you look at the process or not of that being great, I mean, he's at least more willing to take those threes than Jones is. And I think that helped, even just being willing to take them, if not make them. And then when he started hitting them, opened things up for everyone else.
I think that's a good coaching move in the sense, and it's tough to really quantify that, but I think that's where it's like a mental coaching move, a good mental coaching move, where it gives him the confidence now to start versus coming off the bench. Here's a guy who's used to
it's just like, oh, we changed something. Now it's going to be different. Like, it just psychologically help your team think that something is different now because they were getting their butts kicked before.
Yeah, that's a good point as well. Yeah.
Well, so do you think that the Clippers, was this their best chance potentially to win? And do you think that they blew it, or do you think they...
To win like a title?
Yeah.
I think they were drawing dead against Golden State. I mean... Yeah. We talked about the depth and we talked about the pace and how the game doesn't slow down. And Golden State has a better roster. They have better coaching. They have home court advantage. They're finding their groove. I don't really see who the Clippers were going to use to guard Curry for long stretches. Chris Paul could do it, but I don't see him running the offense, carrying the offensive load, and also having to like track Curry around. And then, yeah, I think Golden State would have just exploited that bench, the Clippers bench in depth in ways that they wouldn't have been prepared for. So whether it was their best chance or not, I don't think their best chance was very good. So it probably was their best chance, but I don't think their chance was that great. I don't know. Like, I don't know that you could win a championship with that bench. I'm not sure what they're thinking. Maybe I don't know if their window is closed, because I don't know that they had a window, and I don't know that, I mean, they couldn't possibly do worse from a bench perspective next year, right? I mean, what pieces could they
I don't know. I mean, Crawford, I'm sure they'll keep him around. He's non-guaranteed for next year, but at $4 million you might as well keep him. But he's, I think, you know, struggled with some injuries. He's not going to be as good as he has been in past years.
Right.
So they'll lose him. And then, I mean, you know, Hawes, maybe you could hope would be better next year. They're still going to have problems at backup point guard. I mean, cause they really only are going to have, the most they would have is like $3 million in the mini mid level, I think.
Yeah.
Especially once they re-sign DJ. So it's hard to see, unless suddenly Doc can start finding some gems the way guys like Daryl Morey and you know, some of the other better GMs can, they maybe know better. And Paul's going to be worse too. He just turned 30.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, is it a lock that they re-signed DJ? Is that a lock?
I mean, I think so, just because of the way things are made up, it just would be so hard to replace him. And even if you get him on the max, then when the cap goes up next year, I mean, I don't know if it's a lock or not, but
is it a lock that he wants? I mean, is he unrestricted or restricted?
He's unrestricted, but they'll be able to offer him that fifth year. I mean, it's hard to know, because for the first time ever, really, in the NBA, you have a situation where guys don't want to just get the maximum number of years.
Yeah, they
want
to sign for a year and wait for the TV money to kick in. So I don't know. It's interesting. It'll be interesting to see what Dallas offers him. I know that's the team that's rumored to really want him, and that's the team he's rumored to have interest in. It'll be interesting to see where he goes, if he stays or he goes or what. I'm not sure.
Well, all right. So why don't we move on to talking about these next series that are coming up. What do you think about the Atlanta-Cleveland series? My personal opinion is that Cleveland has really gotten off the hook defensively in these first two series, and that they haven't played good offensive teams who really move the ball and can discombobulate their what's been a lack of communication for them through most of the year. And I think Atlanta can take advantage of that more maybe than people think.
Yeah. It's I was shocked in some ways at how big a favorite Cleveland is. And they're like a 2-1 favorite. And I don't know. I was a little bit surprised at that. I thought the line itself would be closer to even than that. And I do agree with you. I think that Cleveland hasn't, you know, going from the Bulls, which is, you know, going to like a Stone Age offense, to what Atlanta does, I think it will cause Cleveland some difficulties in some ways. I've just been really disappointed with how Atlanta's played in the playoffs. I mean, some of it was with the Washington is a better team than people thought they were.
Yeah.
For sure. And, you know, Bizarro Randy's like a real thing. But part of it is also just, you know, Korver's disappeared. They're not moving the ball as well. They're not really, there's been very few players you could say. I think Millsap is clearly dinged up a little bit. There's very few players you could say that have played really that well for them. I think probably their best players have been Horford and maybe Carroll, I think.
I thought Carroll's been really good.
Yeah, he's a guy who's those are the types of players you need your GM to pick up. But could you imagine
$3 million a year?
So crazy. Millsap as well. Who I remember I had like a post like really, you know, sneaky underrated power forward I never answered, but it was Millsap. And it's amazing that the job they've done, the pieces they've added to that team, the drafting of like the players, like drafting a Schroeder. I'm not a fan of some of their players, but you know, those guys for sure I'm fans of. And so it's really remarkable that a guy like that can be had for $3 million and the Clippers are like signing Byron Mullins and Spencer Hawes and all these other players. It's kind of bizarre. But yeah, I think that's going to be an interesting series. I don't know. I don't think Cleveland is a very good team right now. They don't have very many answers. I think they beat the Bulls, and the Bulls were not a very good team. They just weren't able to really capitalize on any of the things that worked. I don't know that Cleveland's going to be able to. I don't know that playing those two bigs is going to really work. And I know for sure playing Mike Miller or James Jones at the four is not going to work. So
yeah.
I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what type. I mean, the other thing that you do, have LeBron, so that's a big. You know, he can pretty much dial it up to almost as high as it can be dialed up. So it's interesting to see like how much higher you can go to. You're going to see, I don't know who LeBron guards. I don't know who guards Korver. I'm guessing they put Shumpert on him, Smith, and then maybe LeBron at some time. I don't know. Maybe they put LeBron on. I think LeBron at the four is really the answer for that team.
Yeah. I mean, they may need, if they're not going to go with the two bigs. And I do think that those guys, especially Mozgov, like he's not going to be able to just camp out right under the basket the way he did in that Chicago series with Horford out there.
Yep.
I mean, I think they'll probably end up having to have their closing lineup go with Thompson and then LeBron at the four. And he can guard Millsap just fine. It's just a question of, like, of the energy that he's going to be expending.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you match up if you're Atlanta and if you're Cleveland in that series with
who yourself? Who would I have guarding whom?
Yeah. If you're Cleveland, who are you closing the game with, and who are you putting on the Atlanta starters? Assuming it's the Atlanta starting lineup that's closing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm closing with the starters for Atlanta for sure. And I know sometimes they rotate and they put in Schroeder versus Teague for whatever reason, but I'm not a fan of that. I think Teague is
yeah, me neither.
Is better. So I'm probably just putting Kyrie on. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. I think you put. I guess I don't know. I might put
because Kyrie is really he's underratedly bad. I think
but he's picked it up and then he hasn't as bad as he used to be though. He used to be really bad at defense. I don't know that he's that bad now, and he's definitely bad with the injury. But I do feel like he has defended at times better this year in surprising fashion. So I think it's just pretty straightforward. I think you put LeBron on Millsap, like you said. You put Thompson on Horford. If that's the lineup you're going to go with, you put, and then you put Shumpert on Korver, and then that leaves J.R. Smith on Carroll probably.
Yeah. Cause Smith, he can't guard Korver. I don't think he has like the level of concentration.
No. Yeah. He's not.
That you need.
That's an interesting
thing. But
yeah,
I think you probably do have to do that.
Yeah. I think that's interesting because I don't know who on that team really does have that level of concentration. They don't really have like a Shumpert's like their stopper, right? I mean, every team has a stopper. Every good team has a stopper in some ways. Maybe the closest to that is Golden State, who doesn't, you know, their stopper happens to be Klay Thompson, who's also a terrific offensive player, right? I guess Draymond is like the oil that makes their defense go. But like in terms of having a three who defends the other team, like the Reddicks and the Hardens and the Corvers and the Kobes and all these other players, they don't really have that, you know. And I think it becomes difficult for them to match up. I guess Shumpert is their guy, but he's just not that big. He's not that long. And it has to be more of a
point guard.
Yeah, and I mean LeBron is their guy, but if you're going to put a small lineup in there, obviously LeBron has to guard the four. So it makes it tough. I don't know that you could do something funky like put LeBron on someone. You know, this series they don't really need that because Atlanta really plays a team-oriented offensive system anyways. But they definitely would need that if they're able to advance. I don't know what they would do versus Golden State in that sense.
I think we may see Cleveland devolve, and maybe devolve isn't the right term, but I think they're going to have a lot of trouble guarding Atlanta conventionally. I think we may see them do a lot of switching and then trying to force Atlanta to beat them one-on-one, because I don't think that Cleveland's communication and intensity is necessarily going to be high enough,
right,
to guard them in a conventional way where you're sticking with your own man most of the time.
Yeah, that makes sense for sure. And then I don't know, Atlanta has, I mean, does Atlanta without Thabo, do they have the guys? I mean, how many minutes can Carroll play on LeBron? I wonder if we see Millsap on LeBron at some point. I'm guessing we have to at some point, right? Because who else do they have?
I mean, yeah, that'll be interesting. I mean, Millsap is a guy as a four who can guard out in the perimeter a little more than some people can. But I mean, you either got to put Millsap on LeBron, or you got to put him on someone like Smith. They may actually have him guard like Shumpert or something too. But Shumpert was actually able to take advantage of guys in that matchup, at least in the Chicago series on occasion. So
yeah,
I mean, Cleveland, that small lineup for Cleveland with LeBron at the four, when you can't guard him with your four, then it leads to a lot of kind of weird problems and matchups elsewhere.
Yep, for sure. It'll be an interesting series. I mean, I'm sad there's no basketball until Tuesday, but
our girlfriends are probably
probably pretty excited about that. Yeah.
Well, so how about in the West? I mean, we got Houston and Golden State. I mean, my pick's going to be Golden State in five. I won't ask you for yours, but I mean, can you construct a scenario? If Houston's going to win this series, like, how could it possibly happen, if it even is possible?
No injury scenario, right? Just like a straight up.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, Harden could play at the level that it's difficult. I mean, I don't know. They have to run hot from three. I think, you know, the one interesting thing about the Rockets is they are analytically smart. Everyone knows this. And I do feel like they know they're the underdog in this series. And I do think they will junk up the game. And by doing, you know, they will take a lot of threes and just roll with it. And if they hit their threes, they have a chance of winning. And if they don't, they're fine. I don't think they're going to try to play a conventional, we're going to beat you playing our best basketball versus your best basketball. I think it's going to be, we're going to try to junk up this game and create as high variance a game as possible. And I do think you'll see them taking a lot of threes more than, I mean, I don't know. It's difficult because you take what the defense gives you, but I think they'll be happy with guys like Josh Smith casting from three and Ariza taking as many threes as possible and Brewer taking as many threes as possible and Terry and even Harden. I think that they'll be taking a lot. I hate to be repetitive, but I think they'll be taking a lot of threes. I think that's their recipe. I think Dwight in spots where Bogut isn't in there might be interesting. Who knows? They may decide they want to like hack Bogut from time to time. I don't know what Bogut's shooting this year.
Yeah, a listener asked me why they don't do that, and I didn't have the greatest of answers. I felt like simply a lot of it is because they just have plenty of guys behind him that they can just go to, and if you want to go ahead and get in the penalty, and then you know, they can take Bogut out. And I think that Green at center lineup in some ways is.
But I think the Green at center lineup will have trouble with Howard, right? But now do they start hacking Howard? And that would really ruin the series. I don't even want to.
Yeah, from what I understand, Kerr doesn't like doing that because he thinks it slows down all the negatives that we've talked about, basically. I mean, maybe he'll deviate from that. Who knows? But, I mean, like, it's not – this is the thing, though. I think if you're going to try it for, like, maybe three or four times, might as well, because if the other team is, like – and if you're already in the bonus.
Yeah,
like,
you got to be in the – exactly. You got to be in the penalty – and
like that's dumb.
Yeah.
But if you, I mean, if the other, you might do it for a couple possessions just to see if the other coach is like dumb enough to take out one of his best guys.
Yep.
I mean, if you want to get a guy off the floor, maybe it's worthwhile for that. Yeah. But.
And you can do it also in scenarios where I felt like this is the first time where teams are really doing it in these scenarios where it's, you know, the shot clock's off, the team's holding for the last possession. It's funny, like the Clippers have never, you know, that team has never really been altogether that thought. I never really thought that team was altogether that sharp, but they did it a few times. I thought that was smart. It gives you an extra possession. Those are the no-brainer spots. But aside from that, I don't think it's, you know, what Houston tried to do for a few games where they just did it over and over and over again, that was not a winning strategy. But that's not the way to bank up the variance of the game, I don't think. I think you're better off just having Josh Smith almost cast from three in some ways than doing that. But it'll be interesting. Yeah, I'm not sure. They're a sharp team. They'll figure stuff out. I mean, they made some adjustments in this series, but I just think that that Golden State team has been the best team in the league for a reason all year. And the switch that they flipped in Memphis when they got down 2-1 was, I mean, they got a little tight in some of the games early on, and especially the third game they lost. But game three that they lost, but since then, they just look like they're just playing at too high a level at this point.
And I expect that Golden State, their guys are, I think they're going to be able to take away a lot of those Rockets threes, or at least make them more difficult, because number one, they can switch a lot. So
yep.
Harden in the pick and roll, I think he really is only going to be able to draw help and get three pointers when they're running a 1-5 pick and roll. I think if it's 1-4, they'll probably just switch it with Draymond,
yep.
or, you know, if it's Barnes or something. And then also Golden State's guys are just so good at helping and then recovering and running people off the line on closeouts. And that's, you know, those guys are not really that able to make plays off the dribble. You know, someone like Ariza or Prigioni or someone like that who's going to be spotting up, you know, either they're going to be taking a two-point jumper or they're just moving the ball with no real advantage into something else. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't really know of any way that they can – I don't suspect that –
they'll try. I mean, that's obviously the right strategy. It's just it's going to be hard.
Yeah, and I also do think that one of the disadvantages is I don't think you'll see them collapsing on Harden too much when he does get in the paint. I think they'll be pretty happy just having their guy just go straight up, and they do have good rim protection. Whereas I think the Clippers, for whatever reason, just overhelped to the extreme. I think that was a big
yeah, that backside wing was really crashing down. It's hard.
Yeah, and I mean, I tweeted this like in game three or game four, but I was like, I mean, how many times, like, what's the over under on the amount of times Jamal Crawford's just like left his guy open in the corner from three for no particular reason? And it just would happen. It happened over and over and over again. And I don't think you see those types of mental lapses that that the Clippers had. I don't think you see those on defense from Golden State. I haven't seen them really do that. So.
To me, if the Rockets are, and I'll preface this by saying I think a lot of people focus on the referees way, way too much. I'm sure you get all these tweets of people like, oh, they're playing 5-on-8 and all that. I think to the extent that there certainly are referees who don't do that great of a job, and, you know, the way the game is refereed matters, but, you know, I think we both agree there's nobody who's, like, you know, biased against other teams. Maybe you do disagree. But
I disagree with that for sure. I don't think you'll see those guys. You won't see that for the rest of the playoffs. I think you can make a pretty clear argument that there are some refs who in the past have been biased against teams. And you know, there's a couple that actually don't like the Clippers and don't like Doc Rivers. But those are very rare situations. What you end up just having is just like incompetent refereeing, like someone like John Goble, who's just making bad calls all over the place. More than like, making calls to really favor a team or favor the home team or favor the team that's trailing in the series. You don't really see that too much.
Well, so in that vein, I think that the biggest factor for me is going to be how it's going to be refereed. If Harden is getting to the line a lot, if they're getting lots of stoppages, if Howard is getting to the line a lot, if Bogut and Green are in foul trouble, especially Green being in foul trouble, which he's struggled with in these playoffs, and they've been unbelievable when he's on the floor. He is the best plus minus in the playoffs by like 40 points or something like that right now.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's number one for me for Houston, like Harden's got to get to the line. I don't think he can score efficiently against this team with all the switching and all the good defensive players that they have. You know, they're not going to give up a three. They're going to make him shoot a mid-range two. They got too much protection at the rim. So if he's not getting fouled, I think it's hard for him to be efficient. And I think it's hard for them to score with Bogut and Green on the floor. If it ends up being David Lee or Festus Ezeli, who's going to really hurt the offense a lot, then things change significantly.
Yeah, I agree with that for sure. It's interesting too, because Golden State's going from a team that they're going from playing a team that really doesn't take any threes to a team that's going to take a lot of threes. And I don't know that, and it could be what you said, where they just don't allow that many, they close off, but like, you know, Memphis just wasn't able to generate any points from the 3-point line. And I think that was a big reason. You know, they got outscored by 30 points, I think, in the closeout game from the 3-point line, which is just an absurd amount of,
yeah,
or some number like that. It was a big number, whatever it was. I don't remember the exact number, but it was high. It will be a big thing to see if Harden gets those whistles where he just like flops and throws his hand in the air, up in the air. It would be interesting to see. Like, a lot of them are legit fouls. He is good at gaming the system and sticking the ball out. And if you reach, you will get called for a foul. But a lot of the times too, he gets contact and then just like, you know, volleyball sets the ball up in the air with his hands flying out, like Frogger almost. He looks like Frogger when he goes
volleyball
into the lane.
That's what it looks like,
yeah,
right?
Like, or like Frogger, like going into the lane, just like his hands just go straight up in the air. And yeah, those are interesting. We'll see if he gets those. He's very tough to defend.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think in the one game that I have Houston winning in this series, that, you know, it's going to be one of those. And Memphis, too, like, that's when they were able to have success was getting to the foul line. So this is, you'll allow me to change topics for a second here.
Yeah, sure.
There's this reports now out of Chicago that Tom Thibodeau is going to be moving on. They're going to try to trade him. There's going to be a lot of drama there. I'm someone who is from Chicago. I follow the team closely. I was a Thibs supporter for a while, but I'm sort of now moving in the direction that it might be better for them to move on. So, two-part question here. Number one is, do you think that the Bulls got what they should have out of the talent on the team this year? And number two, do you think that it's a good idea to move on from Thibodeau, or should they try and patch it up with him?
I think it's the issues I have with him are just based on the amount of minutes he plays his players during the regular season, just wearing them down. Luol Deng for a number of years, Jimmy Butler now. I think that to me is just insane, and I can't think of any reasonable explanation for it. But I do think he's an amazing defensive coach, arguably the best in the league. Maybe you could make the argument that Ron Adams, when he goes to a team, is a good, you know, he's also a very good coach. Defensive coach, but you know, he's not a head coach, he's just a defensive coach. So I do think that he is good, and I don't know that he, I mean, it's tricky. I don't know. I don't think they're going to really find someone that will make that team a better regular season team, but I think they might find someone who just is able to figure out ways to get that offense going a little bit more. I don't think they've maximized their offensive ability, but then also, you know, Rose hasn't been healthy, and it's tough to lay a lot of the blame on Thibodeau with when his best player is banged up, and Noah was terrible this series. I don't think that Gasol was nearly as good as a lot of people thought he was this year, especially on the defensive boards, and like just on defense in general. So I don't know. I think it could be a win-win in some ways. I think whoever gets him as a coach is going to benefit immensely to start. And I think that there's a possibility that the Bulls players just need a different voice at this point, where they've tried and it's not going to work. And even if they take a coach who's not as talented, it might be beneficial for them.
A lot of the carping with Thibodeau was over the player usage, whether it was playing Heinrich a lot, whether it was not playing Mirotić as much.
The Mirotić thing was, I actually was like, is he dead? Like, what is wrong with Mirotić? Like, going that series, I was like, what is, and then he came in that game and had a great game. I don't know how, like, I get it. He's not a good defensive player, but he's not so bad that his defense is counteracting his ability to space the floor and his offensive production. You can't make that argument with a straight face, and I don't know how he could. especially when Noah was just basically throwing the ball up in the air, hoping it hit like glass or something. It was just terrible.
That was so depressing.
Yeah. So, he wants players who can defend, and those are the players he plays. But I don't think he picks like optimal lineup combinations either. Like even the pairings that he'd used, I think were like the Gasol Noah pairing. I don't think that's a good pairing. I don't think that works in this day. I mean, even if you want to play like a really good defender with those guys, then just pick one of them to start and rest, sit the other one and play Gibson more with that combo, with one of those two, either one of those two, because you do get a little bit more. He's just as good a defender and probably better than, well, he is better than Gasol, and he's a better offensive player than Noah is. So, I don't know. Yeah, I'm not a big fan. I'm not like Heinrich. I don't get why he plays so much. I get it. He's a great defensive, mind, and he's smart and he understands and he never misses his rotations, but his best days are past for sure. Snell would have been a better option. And even just playing those guys during the regular season, I think more would have been better because they would have been more ready to handle minutes in the playoffs.
All right. Well, it's good to know that I'm not the only one who thinks that, and that plenty of other people have said that besides me too. So let's see. I mean, you probably got to get going pretty soon here, but a couple other things I wanted to ask you about, since you follow refereeing more closely than I do. Do you feel like we've seen more of the play where the ref just waits to see whether the guy makes it before calling a foul? And if so, what do you think of that?
I don't know that we've seen more of that. I think that's always been something that's happened. I think it's bad officiating. I think the officiating in the end, I think officiating is very, very difficult. It's a tough thing to do, but I do feel like there's way too much inconsistency with officiating. Like, so with that, I'm not really too sure if it happens more or less, but I do feel like you get more of, there just shouldn't be this dynamic where like the refs are letting them play tonight. Like that shouldn't, a foul is a foul in each game. Like, I don't think you should have these veteran referees who feel like they're going to get the tenor of the game and figure out the pulse of the game and decide how close or how poorly they're, how close or how much they're going to let the players play. I don't think I don't see how that's good basketball or good for the league or good for anything. And I do think there was a Cleveland-Chicago game where it varied from one game to the next, where you had a crew that really called it really tight, and then you had a crew that just let them play. And I don't, obviously that benefits one team over the other when that happens. There's some teams who will benefit from that and some teams who won't benefit. Like the Rockets will not benefit a game where the game is not being officiated, where they're just letting them play. I don't know that the Rockets have very many wins when that happens, right?
Yeah.
And so that's the thing I really harp on more for officiating, just the idea that you have these refs who have, and it's random too. It's not like they go into each game with the same. It's not like you can say this is a referee who's going to let them play. It's bizarre, and it and I don't think that it's match rigging, but it's very. I've never heard a reasonable explanation from it, and probably because the refs aren't allowed to even talk, which is interesting, right? They're not allowed to talk or do interview requests or anything like that. But I would be interested to know what the reasoning for that is, like why. And I don't know if it was game four or whatever game it was where it got really testy. Why the refs were just letting them play that game? Why nothing was a foul, like anything? I'm just curious as to what the reasoning for that is. And then when the game gets, then the next game where it gets really feisty and there's like technicals, now everything is a foul, right? And that's the type of stuff that really bothers me more than anything, just the inconsistency game to game with how the game is officiated within the referee community.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you can only focus on so many things, and referee analytics and something I'm sure is something you've looked at a lot more, and a lot of other people have too, that it's not something that I have spent a lot of time on, so it's good to hear your take on that. So last time before we close here, what do you think, who has like really impressed you both team-wise and player-wise in these playoffs that maybe you weren't thinking of as someone that you were looking at before the playoffs started?
Mozgov, I think, would be the one who, it's not that I didn't think he was a good player, but I was kind of shocked at how well he's played. I think most people would be. He's played really, really well. He's probably been the best big in the East, I would say. Horford's played good. The what really shocked me was just how well Bradley Beal played on defense. That was like something, and the Whitman stuff shocked me, obviously. But
yeah,
in terms of, I didn't really, there wasn't too many other, I mean, the Blake Griffin, you know, there was that, you know, the Blake Griffin is now LeBron James. There was that discussion for like a couple days after, I don't remember that when they beat Houston.
Yeah, okay, yeah, calm down.
Right, yeah, exactly. Like, I don't remember who said that, but I was like, I think it was Tom Haberstroh, and I was like, I get it, it's like clickbait, but it's okay, yeah, maybe for a game or two, that's cool. Austin Rivers was also insert name of good player for a game or two as well. And that didn't really last either. So, yeah, I would say the big player who surprised me a lot would be Mozgov. I'm sure there's others that I'm missing that I can't think of right now, but Mozgov would be the one player that really impressed me more than any other player, I think, this playoffs. So him, and then I've always been a fan of Carroll. So, he, it wasn't so much that he hasn't played good so much as I just expected him to play that well. So.
Yeah, it's really a shame for him that he's not 2 years younger, because he would just get a massive contract,
yeah.
I think, this season. But, you know, Atlanta deserves a lot of the credit. Like, he couldn't shoot threes like this 2 years ago, and he goes there, and now he can.
Yep. It's interesting that the ability to, like, identify these players and extend. And you can say the same thing about Millsap. I mean, Millsap wasn't shooting. There was a game when he could shoot the threes, but he wasn't really shooting the threes, if that makes sense. There was a game where he played for Utah where they played Miami, and he made like four threes.
Yeah,
that overtime game where he just basically brought them back and hit threes. And you could see the threes were just effortless. They were running plays out of timeouts for him to shoot threes down the stretch. It's like, why aren't you letting this guy shoot threes all year? So yeah, but Atlanta definitely deserves a lot of credit for all that. I mean, they really are Spurs East or Spurs Light. And I do think that, you know, we both kind of look at Budenholzer are kind of like, what is going on here? What is he doing it sometimes? But you can't discount the player development, and you can't discount that at all. The players who have gone there and improved, like Jeff Teague becoming like changed completely over, like reworking his entire game and becoming like a paint penetrator like Tony Parker, and just everything. So that to me is real coaching, I suppose. And like the stuff that we talk about on Twitter, the easy stuff, like you should foul here, you should do this. That's easy stuff to me. And that's what makes it more shocking that they don't get that. But the real tough stuff is the game-to-game development and player management and all that other stuff that a lot of these really, really good coaches and culture and team building that a lot of these good coaches really get.
Yeah, and that's why I'm always loath to say this guy's a good coach or this guy's a bad coach based on, you know, a few adjustments. I mean, you know, even someone like Thibodeau, I always defended him like crazy, even though he had some of the issues that you talked about in past years, because they defended at an awesome rate. And that it's a lot easier for me to say, well, maybe they should move on from him now because they didn't do that as much this year. Granted, there was a decline in the personnel as well, but I mean, like Bud, you know, some of the things he did, like waiting until there was a minute left to bring Horford back when he had five fouls.
That's insane. That's where I really do feel like, and this is the future of coaching, and the first team that really gets this will, I think, I mean, there are teams that do it a little bit, but just, I know when I go to a game and I'm sitting like close to the action, I have no idea what's going on sometimes. Like I get some things and I get other things, but you just miss the flow of the game in some ways. And I do think when a coach is out there and he's doing this and he's calling timeouts and he's looking at, you just can't pay attention to everything and know what's going on and have like a real impartial or a real more of like a centered look of what's going on in the game. Your mind isn't normal. You're involved in the action. There's the energy. And I do think like a team that puts someone up in the press box and communicates down to the bench in some way, because I've asked them, there's no rules precluding it. Like the players are allowed to have iPads, but maybe they're not allowed to have Wi-Fi connectivity, but there's so many ways around that I've talked to former coaches and current general managers and that about that. And I really do believe that's like the future of, and having a guy who is maybe not as great a coach as some of these other guys is, but just is a little bit better in like the game theory of basketball and like, hey, you don't need to take this guy out. You're fouling him out of the game. This matchup's working really well. Let's go back to running this play. Let's just the stuff that's data driven as well as insight driven and actually seeing what's going on from a detached role versus being right there on the floor and being in the action and kind of losing your mind. Because I think a lot of these coaches do lose their mind in some ways.
it's hard to see from right there.
It really is. Yeah.
Like, courtside. I mean, I'll go to a lot of these events where, you know, I'm scouting players or something. And if you're sitting down right next to, like, it's really just hard to get like the right angle. It's the same reason why when they show that sorry under the baseline camera angle on a dunk, it looks weird and it doesn't look right. Like you can't quite get the perspective. It's easier, I think, at least if you're standing up or even if you're maybe like, you know, 6-7 rows back.
Or like even far. Yeah, even having like the benefit of just that plus TV plus replay plus rewind plus all that stuff plus box score plus live updating of how much time each team is using for each possession plus everything. Like, I don't know. I was thinking the other day that I want to go like coach like in the D League or something, like be an assistant coach in the D League, because I think it would just be so interesting to see like what type of impact someone like that would have on a team, how many wins per game or how many points per game that person would give to a team, to a good team. Like what benefit would some coaches have? And I think a lot of coaches would benefit a lot, and I think some coaches wouldn't benefit that much. But I do think someone like Bud would benefit a lot from that, from just having someone who's as sharp as he is, but who just has, like, even himself, just have himself another clone of him. I'm not saying I'm intelligent or I'm more, and nothing like that. I'm just saying it's just someone who's detached and has the ability to see, you know, live view of statistics and live view of what plays are working in live metrics and replays and all that stuff, I think would be a big plus for every team.
Yeah, I agree. So unfortunately, neither of us can coach teams from our computers.
No, it's tough.
We can only provide like 140 character at a time recommendations.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I think a lot of it too, though, is just it's interpersonal. It's a trust factor with, you know, because a lot of coaches who have been in the game for a long time, it's just you kind of build up on the foul thing, for example, right? Like you just build up this fear of losing because you didn't make a move, you know, and it's much easier for people to say afterwards, well, you know, he fouled out because you left him in, as opposed to if you take him out, it's not as acute of a death.
Well,
you know, nobody's going to be like, all right, you know, what happened over this 10-minute stretch when he was out? Like, we're starting to get there now in analysis, but compared to just that one, like, all right, he's out of the game, now you're totally deflated, I think it's hard for a lot of people in the moment, as you were saying.
Yeah, you're fouling a player out when you're taking him out of the game. I mean, you really have to have a strong argument for the last few minutes of the game being more valuable than other minutes of the game, and I don't know that anyone's ever been able to prove that. I mean, they're definitely more leverage, and it's definitely true to a small extent, just because you can have, you know, the last point in a basketball game is more valuable because you can control and you can have the last possession, and there's all these other factors that go into it. But in terms of, you know, going on, you know, taking Horford out and not bringing him in and having your team, you know, experience a deficit, I don't know that there's any real argument for that. I don't understand. And then even if you do believe that, I mean, why 1 minute? Like, what? Like, it's okay.
Yeah, well, that I'd never seen anything like that before. That was just I don't know if anyone ever asked him that. And by the way, you always say like, oh, so like, why didn't people ask him that? Like, blah, blah. It's kind of hard to ask people that, especially when you're around the team every day.
Oh, no,
like,
I know. I get it. Yeah.
You know,
this is
based on relationships.
Yeah, exactly. It's a personal thing. And it's an inner, you know, the life is relationship based and how you manage these relationships. And you don't want to have the situation where you had, Whitman and the guy from the Washington Post, where you don't want that type of contentious type of atmosphere all the time.
Yeah.
But I do feel like if you couch the question in an intelligent manner, like, don't give me talk about why you left, you know, if you actually just say like, you know, what was the reasoning behind this? You know, your team went on this, that, just something. I mean, it's tough for a guy like Pop because he is so difficult. But I don't know. I don't think I would wilt under that. I would just be like, here are the numbers. Your team is scoring this many points per possession. Are you aware of this? If so, why are you discounting it? Do you feel like the sound? Just something. And I would just be interesting to see how you would answer that question when he was like resorting to a pack of stuff, you know?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's always easier for us, though, because we sort of, you know, we're not like dependent on that job for our livelihoods.
Right.
Too,
no, so. I get that. Yeah,
yeah.
I get that.
Yeah. Well, all right. I think anything else that has struck you about what about in the Western Conference? Anybody who a player who you didn't necessarily think was as good as he has been, or anything that stuck out to you at all?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the Western Conference kind of, I think more like disappointment in some players than players who kind of who played better than I thought they would play. Kawhi lost his focus a little bit in the spurt in the series versus the Clippers, especially in like the last few games. But that would be just about it. I mean, I thought that series itself was a disappointment for me. I mean, I basically bet on the Spurs every game. I profited because even though the game, you know, they lost one more game than they won, but they actually covered that game. So I profited, but I didn't think that series would be nearly as close as it was. And I thought the Spurs would be able to wear down. So that was a little bit surprising, but other than that, not really. No.
Yeah. I mean, when I went with Clippers and seven in that series, I did it just because I thought that the splitter injury was going to be an issue for them.
It definitely was for the first game when James just got just was terrible the entire game and looked lost.
He may still not be back on social media yet.
Right. Yeah. That was, I mean, there was a video of the dunk, and then there was a video of him after they lost, they went out partying in LA, and there was just like a video of him just like drunk out of his mind. You just see like there's a guy who is not just like, you know, mourning the loss of the season, but like mourning the loss of something else as well. I mean, he just got abused. But I mean, yeah, so that was, I think, a big factor, the splitter. They were a better team with him in. They were getting more open shots with him in because of the types of screens he was setting and getting more penetration and ball movement. And there's more back screens and just everything. And that was, I think, a real underrated factor. But I still think there were so many times where there was that moment, I think, where Pop pulled Kawhi because he missed an assignment. I was at that game. And so,
that was so ridiculous.
Yeah. And so I didn't know what was going on
for
on TV.
Like 7 minutes.
Yeah. 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 And so I didn't know, like, and someone said, no, he did it because of foul trouble, but it was like three fouls in the third quarter or something like that.
It was like two fouls. It was definitely just like,
I'm going to prove a point here.
Yeah.
And I don't think he recovered from that. I don't know. I mean, I'm maybe just like fitting a narrative, but it seemed like he lost focus, and maybe he had already lost focus. But I felt like even if that was the case, and it was a case where he's still an unfocused Kawhi, like, oh God, my God, God forbid he let someone go backdoor. He's your best fucking defensive player aside from Duncan by a long shot. I just thought that was really like a poor time to kind of prove a point. But hey, I'm like sitting on my sofa and he's, you know, polishing his championship rings and trophy. So I don't know, but I felt like that was, I think, I don't know. And then seeing him not be able to make a shot in game seven, like shots that were rimming out and shots that were just, and then just barely missing rebounds. I just felt really bad for him because he is my favorite player, one of my favorite players. And, so that was maybe, one of the disappointing things, but I still think he's a top 10 player for sure.
Yeah, I think, and when I did a list of my top 10 players about 2 months ago now, and I had him just out of the top 10. I think if I had it to do over, I would have had him at you know, maybe 9 or 10 personally. But that was, you know, he was in the same tier as the guys who I had, you know, 9 or 10. And embarrassingly, my number 10 was Lillard, so I think I might do that one over again.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I at least had Blake, you know, I think I had him at like number 7 or something when after his down year. So that, I think that was validated somewhat.
Sure. Oh, the one player who did surprise me a lot, it was such a long time ago, but it was McCollum. I was like, I mean, I thought he was like Randy Foy light earlier in the year, in a sense that because he was only getting garbage time minutes for a while, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, he was, you know, in the one game where Stotts just decided he was just going to foul and get layups for like the entire last minute of the game. He was just excelling at getting those layups. But then when they actually played him in actual regular minutes where it wasn't just garbage time, he was still getting to the rim. And Memphis really had nobody they could stay in front of. And that was like a series where I was shocked at how poorly Stotts adjusted. Like that was, I think we were talking about that where it was such a long time ago, but that was something that surprised me as well, with just how clueless he was at how much.
Yeah. Not bringing in Leonard earlier.
Leonard and McCollum were versus Swallow and Lopez. So yeah, but McCollum impressed me. I came away a CJ McCollum fan, whereas I thought he was a joke before then, and I was clearly wrong about him. The guy can play for sure.
Yeah, I'm not quite as on board with him yet. I mean, it's certainly encouraging that he was able to do what he did in the playoffs. I mean, I think he was also like really bad the first 2-3 games of that series, as I recall. And then I think he just kind of started hitting shots. I'm not sure that I think he's really still reliant on hitting his mid-range jumpers.
No, go back and take a quick look. Like take a quick look of like all his points or all the minutes he was out there. If you have those types of tools and watch it, because I went back and did that, and he's got a quick first step. And look, he's terrible on defense. I'm not saying that he's like a huge plus player, but they had nobody who he wasn't just getting mid range. He was getting to the rim at will. He was getting layups and he was getting layups and threes. It was like shocking to me. That's a player who I would keep my eye on in the next little while and see if he can make that big jump in the off season to work on his game, because I think he really impressed me a lot with that having that ability to get to have, especially against, he wasn't doing it against a bad defensive team, and he was doing it against some good defensive players. Calathes, as terrible as he is on offense, is a good defensive player, and he was unable to guard him. So was Courtney Lee. Neither one of those guys could handle him. So yeah, maybe I'm overthinking it because I just remember seeing those games, but I did come away really impressed.
Yeah, and I mean he was drafted number 10 for a reason.
Sure.
And if Jamal Crawford has made a career out of sort of just hitting those shots at a rate better than you think he might be able to. I mean, and I guess it'll be,
he's a way better player than Jamal Crawford. Yeah. I can tell you that right now. Like he's not taking as many bad shots. Maybe it was just a short thing in the playoffs where the light switch went on, but even, I don't know. I went and watched a bunch of his clips. Like I had the ability to like to go through and like watch every possession and the person's on the court or every possession when they have the ball and all this other stuff. And just being able to do that and watch him, I came away impressed.
Yeah. I'll have to take a look at him more than now that you say that before next year. All right, well, so I think that probably about wraps it up. Thanks a lot for giving us your time.
Hey, I enjoyed it. It was good.
Definitely appreciate it.
Definitely do it again.
What's your Twitter handle for people who want to follow you?
Haralabob, Haralabob.
All right, well, thanks again for being on. Danny and I will probably be back tomorrow on Monday night to preview the upcoming series and also maybe talk a little bit about some draft prospects. I'm going to try and watch some film tonight and see what I can come up with there. I'm Nate Duncan NBA on Twitter. You can subscribe on iTunes or at the Real GM page. Thanks again to Bob for coming on, and we'll talk to you next time.